Hello, this is Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from the studios of PCJ Radio International. I'm Keith Powell. Papua New Guinea's capacity to hold high-level corruption to account is under the spotlight after a former prime minister was implicated in a Singapore money laundering case. Last week, a Singapore court jailed a couple of laundering $3.6 million of funds intended to set up a community colleges in PNG. The court established that in 2010, $784,000 of the money was deposited in a bank account of Sir Michael Somare, PNG's prime minister at the time. Johnny Blades has more.
In the wake of the Singapore case, Sir Michael Somare has apologised for the shame caused to his country. However, in a statement, he said that at no time in his political career had he received inducements or bribes. The chairman of PNG's anti-corruption agency, Task Force Sweep, Sam Coyme, says his team had been working with Singaporean authorities on the case. He says the Singapore court system has sent a clear message that it won't tolerate movement of illicit funds through its financial system.
They didn't wait for PNG as the victim country or Exim Bank or whoever for that matter to lodge a complaint. They detected a suspicious transaction through the money laundering regime that they have and proceeded to investigate the case, and that's how it has ended up.
He says cooperation from other jurisdictions where proceeds of fraud in PNG is transferred to is critical to successful prosecution of corruption. Mr. Coyme hopes Australia will follow Singapore's suit, since a lot of PNG's white-collar criminals tend to buy property or hold their money in Australia.
I believe there are many, and it's up to Australia to have the political will to actually take a step like what Singapore did. But as to the political will, I'm yet to see one that will push them to actually doing something about it.
Sam Coyme says the conclusion of the Singapore case will assist his team in finalising its own line of investigations on the matter. Yet this has been a problem area of recent times, since PNG's police fraud squad began pursuing the arrest of the current Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, over his role in alleged illegal state payments to a law firm. The warrant was stayed by the courts, and subsequently the police hierarchy directed the fraud squad to present all high-profile cases to a vetting committee before any arrests can be made. The head of the fraud squad, Matthew D'Amato, admits it's created an obstacle.
It's kind of put a stop to our investigations because
it's kind of put a stop to our investigations because we deal mostly with high-profile people and investigations. The vetting and all this, it's not really helping us.
Sir Michael Somare's former Deputy Prime Minister Sam Abal admits that corruption is a recurring problem for PNG.
The institutions are there to battle it. The thing that we have to do continuously is to strengthen our institutions, so institutions are run by people anyway, so choose the right people and then they've got a commitment, you know, to running those institutions and making their presence and their part, you know, in role-playing for the countries at different stages of development, so it's very important what they do.
Meanwhile, Sir Michael says he will seek clarification regarding the Singapore case and consult with his legal counsel about how to address the matter. This is Johnny Blades.
A Fiji businessman was left dead after being attacked in his home on Tuesday, allegedly by security forces. The man, Rajnel Singh, had earlier blown the whistle on the assassination plot against two members of the Fijian government. Mr. Singh's lawyer, Ahmed Ravidendra Singh, told Sally Round about the attack.
I can confirm that he has been attacked, he had been attacked on Tuesday of this week, between possibly 2 p.m. and 4 p.m. So I personally visited him at the hospital. Now, what I can clearly ascertain is that this was an attempted murder on Rajnel Singh, because after he was beaten, a plastic bag was tied over his head and fastened with industrial tape, while his hands and legs were also tied with industrial tape. From what I gather, he had been left to literally choke and possibly die. So that's why I'm concluding that it was an attempted murder. Fortunately for Rajnel Singh, one of his family members returned home to find him in that state.
So where is Mr. Singh now, and how is he? What is his condition?
His condition is bad. He has been released from hospital. He's back living with family members at this point in an undisclosed location.
Do you have any inkling as to who was behind the attack? Has he said anything to you about what the men were wearing, who they might be?
He has obviously mentioned a few things. It's very difficult for him to even speak with all the trauma that is associated with that particular attack. But I've managed to find out a few things. And from what he has described, there were two persons. There were, I think, signs of persons wearing Fiji police force attire. And at the scene of the attempted murder, when I visited his home, there is a jacket which has the Fiji police force insignia. But that's what I have been told. Now, obviously, it could be anyone wearing a jacket.
You say the jacket was left behind in his home?
Yes, there is a jacket left behind.
From that incident, and it wasn't there before?
No. It's a Fiji police jacket.
So why would the police be involved in this incident, in your view?
Again, this man was tortured by members of the Fiji police force and members of the security forces, including the military, on or about the 21st of November. As far as I'm concerned, there has been a concerted effort to cover up the persons who were involved in torturing Reginald Singh. It is not rocket science for the investigators to find out who exactly were behind this incident. So 2 months away from now, it will be a year, and not one single person has been brought to justice or has been brought charged and brought to the courts. Not one single person has been interviewed as a suspect in the incident of brutally torturing Reginald Singh. And it is not difficult. Reginald Singh was picked up outside Bar Police Station on about the 21st of November by members of the police force. He was taken in a vehicle which was a police vehicle by 4 men. He was tied, handcuffed and hooded and taken into the interior of Bar, where there were other men who took turns in torturing and brutalizing Reginald Singh. Now, this is a serious crime. And yet the Fiji police force, despite all its assurances, all the rhetoric, have not been able to apprehend one single person. In fact, as far as I'm concerned, no one will be brought to justice. And I had predicted this last year, and I've maintained that. Why? Because members of the security forces involving the police force, the military, and also the prison people, they're all involved in torture. This is an everyday occurrence. Here we see an attempted murder taking place. The Fiji police force, despite being informed on that very day, have yet to take any action. In fact, they have yet to even visit the scene of crime.
And this is the latest incident you're referring to?
Yes, this is the latest incident. There was a member of the police force present at the hospital when I visited Reginald, and we all agreed to go and visit the crime scene. And halfway through, police vehicle pulled off and went on a different tangent. So I'm very confused as to why the police have not, and even I contacted a senior member of police. I even sent him a text message after my phone call was not received to say that there has been an attempt to murder Reginald Singh.
Allegations of racism and discrimination among New Zealand's midwives and staff in maternity care are raising concerns about cultural sensitivity in the workforce. Several women have made claims that they have experienced or witnessed racism and discrimination in maternity care. Figures from the Midwifery Council show that the number of registered midwives is dominated by those from European backgrounds, who make up nearly 90%. Indira Stewart has more.
Midwife Sharon Robinson says often healthcare providers don't even seem to be aware that their comments are discriminatory. She said she had seen discrimination against mothers who were obese.
Unfortunately, when midwives are saying things like all Islanders come over and want to eat McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken every day, and they're making choices.
Have you witnessed those kinds of comments in your practice?
Yes, yes, I have, and it's very disheartening. And I have seen women, you know, behind their backs, midwives say, you know, oh, I think she just sits on the beach and eats taro all day, you know, and that's just not acceptable.
Ms. Robinson says even if negative comments are made in private, the attitudes affect the quality of care given and the safety and confidence a mother feels. Tongan Māori mother Vasiti Palivi agrees and says her experience at a private birthing unit was horrible.
The receiving midwife sort of said some derogatory remarks to me. My waters had broken in the car, so I was somewhat covered in birthing fluids. And so when I arrived, she sort of made me feel really quite inferior. She made me actually feel like I was dirty.
Academic researcher Ruth D'Souza says there needs to be more cultural understanding and awareness within maternity care in New Zealand. She recalls an incident during her work at an Auckland hospital where staff asked a young teenage boy to find out how much blood his mother had discharged.
I had asked if we could get an interpreter, and the person who was in charge that day said, no, we're going to have to use her family. And the only person that could be used was her son. And so we were asking his son if he could ask his mother about how much blood was on her pad. And it just felt so inappropriate. And I was so upset because, you know, that seemed all kinds of wrong for me.
Labour's social development spokesperson Carmel Cipollone says she's not surprised at some of the stories.
I just have had my experiences, and I know that others have had experiences as well where they were made to feel slightly uncomfortable.
She was 20 years old when she went into labour with her eldest son and says she felt dismissed when she called for a nurse to ask for pain relief.
I can remember really clearly her kind of rolling her eyes at me, sitting down on the bed next to me, holding my hand and looking me in the eye and saying to me, just remember, you're the one that wanted to have this baby. Then she smiled and then got up and walked out. And I can remember thinking, I can't believe she just said that to me.
New Zealand Midwifery Council Chair Dr. Judith McCarra-Cooper says the council has clear frameworks around cultural safety within the practice.
It's really distressing for me to hear as a midwife, and to be honest, as a New Zealander. For us in Midwifery Council, we have really clear expectations around cultural competence. You know, cultural competence is valued as highly as clinical competence. So midwives are really aware of what's expected of them.
Of the 3,033 registered midwives last year, only 174 were Māori and 31 were Pacific. Dr. D'Souza says often systems can be insensitive without meaning to be.
What we often forget is that the healthcare system has its own distinctive culture, and it reflects the dominant culture's values and practices.
Dr. McCarra-Cooper says the Council and New Zealand College of Midwives take cultural competence and safety seriously.
It would be naive not to think that, as an academic, that in our institutions there aren't hegemonic interests at play. Absolutely. You just need to talk to anybody from another culture who goes into our institutions. But in terms of midwifery, we work really, really hard that women who are different from us, that we work with them in ways that are respectful and acknowledge what they need and their families need.
Midwife Moon Carson says she hasn't seen any racism within the workforce and believes some comments are often misconstrued.
There's quite a few midwives that have come from overseas that work here, and I don't think that they're as aware, and I don't think they try as hard to have a cultural awareness. I know I definitely try really hard to make sure I'm culturally aware of things.
Midwife Sharon Robinson says women in labour are very sensitive and vulnerable, and it's important for them to feel safe culturally, spiritually, psychologically and medically. In maternity care, babies are entitled to 10 free visits from a midwife and a well child worker in their first year. But recent Ministry of Health figures show over 4,000 babies received no visit within their first 12 months. Of that group, Māori and Pacific made up 43.5% and families classed as the most deprived made up 34%. Ms. Sepuloni says those figures are concerning.
Off the top of my head, I can imagine that part of the reason would be that for Māori and Pacific, there are real housing issues, and so transience would be an issue, and whether the health sector is keeping up with where our women are moving to after they have babies.
Dr. Makara Cooper says the council is working on launching a series of workshops that will address cultural competence and safety and would like to see more diversity among midwives. This is Indira Stewart.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Following this year's International Day of the Disappeared in Bougainville, there are calls from families of the missing for a permanent memorial. Each year, those missing from a decade-long civil war of the 1990s are remembered on August the 30th. A spokesman for families of the missing say people want more than just marking the day with memories. Dominic Godfrey has more.
The Bougainville Civil War was the Pacific's bloodiest conflict since the Second World War. As many as 20,000 people died while Papua New Guinea forces suppressed Bougainville separatists, fighting for political and economic self-determination. Today, there are many whose fate is still not known, but their lives are commemorated around the International Day of the Disappeared. The head of communications for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Papua New Guinea, Dan Waits, says this year is a first.
Each part of Bougainville has a slightly different culture. They feel kind of distinct, and the families of missing persons in each place want to mark the day and to remember their missing loved ones in their own way. So recently, families in Buin came together. They're considering establishing an association of families of missing persons there, and they decided to mark the day for the first time this year.
This year saw each of the three zones in Bougainville commemorating separately over 3 days. It began in the central town of Arawa with a traditional house cry. Buka in the north followed, then the southern town of Buin for the first time. At Loloho Beach in Arawa, there was a service to remember those thrown into the sea and whose bodies will never be recovered. A symbolic burial. The president of the Families of Missing Persons in the North wants to see something more than symbolism. Scholastica Miriori wants a formal acknowledgement of the existence of mass graves.
I wish that they can come together, those two governments, Papua New Guinea and the autonomous region of Bougainville, so that something could be done. Maybe a monument can be erected, and then a list of names or maybe something to represent those that are in the mass graves.
Mrs. Miriori's comments are echoed by the Families of Missing Persons founder, who says people are questioning how long they can keep marking the day without anything tangible to remember them by. Peter Garuai says the autonomous Bougainville government needs to recognise the substantial loss.
How long are we going to celebrate this thing? The government should be assisting the families of the missing persons with something that is tangible, you know. They died for a service. And the government and the people who are responsible for this thing, this is for something tangible for the missing families, you know, memorial or even sustainability.
Along with a monument, Mr. Garuai says families are calling out for skills-based training to help sustain them, particularly the widows. But the chairperson of the consultative committee set up to establish the fates of missing persons, Josephine Kaono, says this year's focus is to implement policy outlined last year by the ABG.
This consultative committee requiring all people, including families of the missing persons, so that everybody can be prepared for the referendum.
The referendum for independence from PNG is slated for June 2019. This is Dominic Godfrey.
An audit report into allegations of corruption and mismanagement at Cook Islands Anangangri Prison is still to be completed. The report was sought by Parliament after a member of the public laid a complaint with the Public Expenditure Review Committee and Audit. Our correspondent, Ragatoga Florence Sim Bukan, spoke to Don Wiseman about the progress of the audit.
The details of that complaint haven't been made public, but speculation is that it centres on the management of the Arorangi prison, the treatment of the prisoners, and allegations of an illegal business, catering business, that was run out of the prison
using prison resources and labour.
It does sound remarkable that all of these nefarious or allegedly nefarious activities were taking place in what would presumably be a pretty small prison.
Yes, it's not a large prison. There are 18 staff, and the allegations have been made that the corruption has been going on for a number of years.
This audit's not done yet. There was an expectation, I think, that it would be presented to Parliament this year. Parliament's meeting next week, presumably for a very short time, because that's the manner of things in the Cook Islands, isn't it? So it's not likely to be presented to Parliament before the end of the year, is it?
Well, the hope is that it will be presented, but as the Director of Audit, Alan Parker, has said, the government entities that are involved with the audit or included or mentioned in the audit will have to be given the opportunity to respond to the report. So they will have 14 days to do that. He didn't even say whether the report has actually gone to these entities yet. And yes, our parliament is not known to sit for very long. It's only sat for 10 days so far this year. So the likelihood of that audit report, long-awaited audit report, coming before Parliament is pretty slim.
Now, issues with Aorangi Prison, there've been a few over the years, and these latest events, they bring to mind what happened 20 years ago, and this horrific situation that was revealed by the then Chief Justice, Sir Peter Quillam, described it as one of the worst events he had heard of to do with prisons anywhere. And this involved a prisoner who had been kept in solitary confinement for months on end.
Yes, that prisoner had been kept in appalling conditions for, at one stage, 14 months in a penal grade solitary confinement in a cell that measured just 6 feet by 7 feet, no light, in almost total darkness for almost 14 months. And what the late Sir Peter Quilliam also said was that he was astonished that this man came out of the situation still sane.
This sort of treatment is no longer found in the prison. They have improved.
One would expect that they have improved since that most awful event of 20 years ago, that yes, we do expect that the prison has improved, but there have also been allegations of prisoner abuse that have been made, so one must wait and see what the report contains.
New Zealand's Tongue and Language Week was kicked off with a celebration of unity and culture in Wellington. Tonga is the third largest Pacific group in New Zealand, with just over 60,000 people identifying as Tongan, most of them born in New Zealand. Koro Wakawata attended the Polatu, or night service, which opened the week on Sunday.
More than 20 churches and community organisations were represented at the service beginning Wiki Katoa Ngai o e Lea Whakatonga, which featured numerous choral items. A speaker at the event was Tailulu Luisa Funua Fayamani, Clinical Director of the Whono West Health and Social Services in Auckland. Dr. Funua Fayamani says being able to speak Tongan helps her deal with many of her patients.
They can understand, they can tell you what their needs are, rather than through a translator, which is really, really important. And we need more people in the health force who can communicate in the different languages in order to provide for the Pacific people are very high needs and they get all the bad statistics in terms of health. So being able to communicate with them will be a step further in terms of helping them.
Dr. Funua Fayamani says being able to speak Tongan helps people identify who they are and participate culturally. She says she's noticed many New Zealand-born youth struggling with the language, so it's up to older generations to help them feel comfortable at attempting Tongan.
Parents needing to learn that they're the way to teach their children. You know, they can't expect the children are just going to absorb it in. They've got to be involved as well. So that's why you need to be addressing really from the really young right through to the old.
Kolovula Murphy runs a weekly cultural program and agrees that intergenerational interaction is important, saying she was proud of the children's involvement at the Polotu.
Because even some of them, they don't understand yet, but they can hear the parents and also the grandparents. They are really great help for them. That's why they're playing around and enjoying themselves.
9-year-old Lisiele took part and says learning Tongan brings her extended family together.
I get to spend time with my family.
We have tongue and language school every Monday, and we have celebrations there, and we have lots of tongue and food.
22-year-old Cielsi says Tongan Language Week has brought the community closer together.
We only see usually the Methodist. If we're Methodist, then we'll just see the Wellington. But for this, it's the whole, pretty much all the Tongan churches in Wellington. So it's good to see them all.
17-year-old Falakia was born in New Zealand but schooled in Tonga. He says being able to speak Tongan means he can transition between the two countries seamlessly.
The Tongan language, standing from my culture and in my country, yeah, help me to be Tongan, because when I get Tongan, I speak Tongan heaps.
Kolovula Murphy says all Tongans need to work together to ensure their language and culture stay strong.
It's so special for all of us, even Tongan, they are born in New Zealand, and those they were born back in Tonga, back home. It's a mixed culture, but it's so important for everyone to carry on the traditional inheritance as we are Tongan.
The week is being officially marked in Tongan communities from Auckland to Timaru in the south and ends on Saturday. Kokoro Vakauta.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you'd like to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. Also, let us know how you heard the program, either on our Pacific partner station, Shortwave FM, or on satellite. Actually, where the program also airs on DAB Plus in Poland on Polish radio. Anyway, that's all we have time for. Until next time, friends, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well. Tune in Monday to Friday for the 3-time daily 15-minute edition of the program. Until next time, so long and take care.